Today is May 5th. We're having review of the sections on the exam for Ancient Near East, Bible and Ancient Near East. And the evidence before us is that there are a lot of rituals that we perform, some in the negative, some even in the positive, that have parallels in the Ancient Near East. And we can use the information as we wish. If the Torah says don't cook milk and meat together, and we have a Nabataean or Sabian reference of doing just that, the Rambam already says in Hilchos Avodah Zarah, there are a number of not only general mitzvahs the Torah says we shouldn't do like the Gentiles, just simple mitzvahs called Chukos Hagoyim. I'm sure you're all familiar with it. It doesn't seem to be specific in that mitzvah. It just says Chukos Hagoyim. If they like to cut their hair in a certain way, don't do that. You're imitating them. Right? They shave in a certain way, don't do that. That's the Rambam in Hilchos Avodah Zarah says there are some specific mitzvahs that the Torah gives us which are meant to be to drive us away from Chukos Hagoyim. And I just gave two examples. He says that the prohibition of shaving with according to oral tradition, dafka with a razor on certain places of the face is because that's how especially idolatrous priests used to shave. Christians went along with this. Remember, you ever see what do we call a priest in the Middle Ages? A galach. Because he just has a bald spot in the middle, and then they just have hair in it here, and the whole thing is just a bowl, straight across, right? So those are specific examples. And so the Rambam's chiddush, not only in the Maribuch, right? Sefer just came out and said that the Rambam's Mishnah Torah is much more controversial than the Mor Nebuchim. Right, you can find such passages, but especially the Chosar Bo Dizara, where the Rambam says specifically a number of the Surim of the Torah meant to drive us away, to wean us away in some cases from idolatrous practices. So here is on the first section, be capable of recognizing, I just mentioned it, all the ones on exam, okay? So it's just be capable of recognizing certain rituals, okay? And you have to recognize the mitzvah, right? If you have to recognize what Orla and Revai is to know how it is parallel to a whole chapter of the Code of Hammurabi, which is how you get to eat your fruits after you plant a tree, right? 500 years before the Torah was given, Hammurabi gave a description of how you get to eat your fruits, how by my largesse and my goodness you get to eat the fruits that I make grow for you, right? So the exactly parallel reference in next week's Parsha, right? It would be this week's Parsha, wasn't it? If it wasn't this week's Parsha. It says that when you plant a tree, you wait 4 years, 3 years do this, fourth year do this, the fifth year do this. It's really quite parallel, and then just be capable of responding. What's the point? Is that there is a culture in the Ancient Near East that your tree grows by the largesse and the goodness of your king. He is in charge of your life, and he's in charge of the nature that endows the earth to support you. He's going to protect you from an enemy. He is, Hammurabi himself says he's a deity, right? He's the author of this law because he has it at the divine level. So the Torah wants to say, listen, I'm not being given in a vacuum, but I just want people to know that my nation, that I'm willing to craft mitzvahs that are familiar to them. This is highly plausible. Okay, what we did with language in the beginning of the semester, we're doing with mitzvahs at this point. There's nothing really unusual about this at all, from the standpoint of what we've been doing. Okay, all right. Okay, so what I could pick on 100 examples in the Torah, but the
concentrated especially on the mitzvahs that have to do with the occult. Early man was very superstitious. A lot of what we call science today was answered by the occult at the time. What is that loud noise we see after a streak of light at night? You know, what causes the moon to disappear right before our eyes in an hour and to just reappear on the other side? Right? So, what causes the sun to disappear, we've heard in some places, just in the middle of the day? Right? What causes that those colors that come in an arc across the... They felt that these were the sun rising and setting every day was a god traveling across the sky in a chariot. So they needed a Avodah Zarah to explain a lot of these things, right? And these things led to various superstitions. And the main superstition was how to forestall or be better, conquer death. Drink from the fountain of youth and live forever. They mummified, they did all kinds of things to assure that this person would live on. Right? And also the concept of the immortality of the soul. But the soul must depart from the body at some time. Right? And the ancients would do everything they can, especially to pull back something who just departed as soon as possible. Right? The best way to do that is to just slaughter them. Right? I think this is a bit of a chiddush that's found in Shmuel David Lutzato. Remember, we looked at him the very first day. We looked at some of the passages about the nature of mitzvahs. And he says something amazing. He says, try to figure out what the word kadosh means. Everyone here is going to say holy. If you want to really, you have to take your BDB, brow driver and Briggs, look up how it's used in Tanakh. Okay, separate is getting closer. But he claims it's not. He says it's not. It doesn't fit certain usages very early on in the Torah, especially you have to go in the Torah. By Nechemiah it means holy, that's no doubt. By Esther it means holy. But if you want to look at some very early references, and it really defies a single interpretation, and Shaddai, using whatever he had, maybe he might, if he had Ugarit and more Akkadian at hand, he might have come to the conclusion, or I should say, he would be able to prove his conclusion better. He thinks that kadosh is a combination of two words, kadesh, to kadesh. It is a Gemara that actually says this. What does the Torah say? What will happen to your grain if it's planted right next to grapes? What happens to it? Very awesome. It's one of the most awesome things in the world. Right, this is called Kilaya Kerem, and it's the only thing that's just as awesome as this is Basa B'Cholov. Why are these two things so much more awesome than everything else in the world? Because everything else in the world is awesome only in the normal way you use it. You can take pig intestines and put it on a wound, and that's fine. But Basa B'Cholov and Kilaya Kerem are totally awesome in any form, in any way. Even comedy on Pesach, if it gets too hard, you can use it as a doorstop. If the dog wouldn't eat it, it's not forbidden. Right? But Kilaya Kerem, Bas B'Cholov, and it fits because they have a Hotisara ramifications to them. What happens if you put grapes and grain together? It becomes, the Torah says, Pentikdash. That combination becomes holy? If it's holy, why can't I eat it? Right? Pentikdash. It's very strange. It almost fits a Rishon. The Bechor Shor says the reason why we don't wear woolen linen, he gives a totally different explanation than we gave in this course, which is that's what the idolatrous priests wore to show dominance over plants and animals, so you don't wear that. Who does wear Shabbos every day? Kohen, and certainly the Kohen Gadol. So the Bechor Shor says, no, Shabbos is holy. It's too holy for the average Jew. So what happens to Kilayah Kerem when you put grains near these things? Go on God's Mizbeach. So here's what Shaddal says. He thinks Kodesh, Kodshin, has to do with the word fire. Kodesh. What do you burn? You burn that which you think is holy. And the eight that what the Torah wants to do in Parshas Kedoshim, that's why it talks so early on in the Parsha about Karbanos. What is it in Karbanos? Why are Karbanos called Kodshim? Because there's a particular very famous, perhaps the most famous narrative in Sefer Bereishis, where God is trying to teach his people, if you want to know what's holy, burn animals, don't burn people. Says Hosea. They slaughter people, but they kiss their animals. Right? The ancients felt, how do I get my God better to protect me? He doesn't want a bull, he wants a person. They kill a person, drink their blood right afterwards, and communicate with the gods in order to gain secrets they need to forestall the death that I just visited upon this person. Rabban says this is Peirush. It's amazing. Rabban uses parshanut to say that's why the Torah says lo tochlu al hadam. It doesn't say lo tochlu dam. Lo tochlu al hadam, which is getting us already involved with the no seances, no ov, no yidoni, no cult, no magic. That's why not drinking blood, whenever it appears, especially the two parshas that deal with the occult, which is Kedoshim and Shoftim, in the middle of a whole series of mitzvahs in both places, lo senachashu, lo sameneinu, right? Lo kosein. In the middle of both of those sections, the two main sections of the Torah that deal with Isurim of magic, right in the middle of both of them, don't drink blood. Right? Okay. That's not, I must say, it's not the singular reason in the Torah to explain our abomination of blood. Other explanations too. It has to do with the life of the animal, it has to do with the fact that it's a kapara on the mizbeach. But the idea of using the atonement through the blood of an animal as opposed to the blood of a human was this huge new chiddush. We don't feel it, of course, but it's a huge chiddush. Halavai, we should have not needed the blood of an animal either, say so many of our prophets. Right? And Midrashim, of course, the Rambam and the Morning Book and the others who follow his path. But we needed it. Okay, fine. There it is. We needed it. Okay? The later prophets explain very clearly what happens when you lose the sight of the morality and you make the car. Right? Remember we did that when we did the first pasuk, the Eila HaMishvatim Asher Tosim Lifnehem, and this is my segue into the next session of the exam, which is going to be on civil law. Right? Remember the Eila HaMishvatim Asher Tosim Lifnehem? Please make my day. Tell me what we said about Lifnehem. Asher Tosim Lifnehem. These are the Mishpatim that you shall place. The word Lifnehem is darshaned in a number of ways by Chazal. Simply, it's profoundly digressing from the Code of Hammurabi, which writes in its introduction, this code is not to be studied by the masses. It's for me and my holy of holies to be only glanced by me and my high priest, and that never leaves this room. There's no Code of Hammurabi for the masses. You learn the basic laws. I mean, what? Is everyone here going to be a lawyer? Right, you know what I'm saying? But every Jew is a lawyer. Because we're at least supposed to study Bava Metzia, Bava Kama, Bava Basra, and Sanhedrin, and Makos, and Shuras. We're supposed to know the law. Put it before them. Not like that, like those old codes say, that it's only for the high priests and the lawyers. Everyone's supposed to know the law. We know basically that don't pass the light in the car when the color is that color. We know some basic laws, right? But what Nehem is teaching is that it's open for everybody, which is a big chiddush. Come on, don't you remember the other parish we gave? The Kli Yakar, Ve'el Mishpatim Asher Tosim Rif Nehem. What comes in the Torah after Parshas Mishpatim? Good. What's Truman Tetzavik Kisisa Leyaka Bakudavik Kutzav Shmini all about? A Mishkan and what you do there. So now tell me, Ve'el Mishpatim Asher Tosim Lifnehem. Lifnehem, a plural word, in although it looks masculine, although the word looks feminine in its plural form, it's masculine word, karbonos. Ve'el Mishpatim Asher Tosim Lifnei Karbonos. You get it? Make sure that to give them primacy of the mishpatim before the korbanos. Didn't we do that pasuk in Yirmiyahu when he said, "When I took you out of Egypt, I didn't teach you about sacrifice." Lo, the old Tzivitzi is come out of the very old of Azava. Right?
there's blood on the doorposts. You show how you roast it so they can smell it. Roast it whole so they can see it. Get out of the system of an Egyptian. If you don't want to do that, you don't deserve to leave. Then, the first major corpus of law after God appears to them in Har Sinai and reveals himself, and then gives us, it's Ve'el Mishpatim Hashem, to sit the hand before I teach you Kabbalahs. You get it? Okay. Alright. What's interesting is that what immediately follows the Inyan of Kachin is Tumah and Tahara. Torah talks about curing Tumah and Tahara. This is not an unusual thing. Ancient Near East has plenty of ritual impurities as well. What's interesting, though, is that in the realm of Tsaras, this would appear that we should need a doctor to cure these things. Right? Instead, the Torah has a Kohen to cure. If I had Tsaras, I would go to a dermatologist. Right? The Torah talks about the cure of the spiritual person. That this, what you have can be cured with spiritual things. Change your ways. Look internally. Now, that's not just the effect of the Torah. This was in Moshe Greenberg. I gave you an assignment very early on to read a few pages in Greenberg about the difference between the way the Torah wants to cure these diseases and how it's covered nationally. It's the difference between the doctor and the Kohen. Look at it. There's only a few pages on the beginning of the readings of Greenberg. Okay, and okay. So now, when it comes to civil law, the main focus is, of course, in Parshas Mishpatim. I gave you a number of pages from Shalom Paul's book on cuneiform law. That's what he calls the scope of. He concentrated on a few countries, in Egypt, in Sumeria, and of course Mesopotamia. Actually, mostly on about 5 law codes, but he sometimes gets off into others. And we contrast some of the way the Torah treats the slave, the human slave, the slave amongst your counterparts, the slave from another place. The basic difference, overall difference, is that the Torah says, Torah echas yiyeh lochem l'ager ha-gor v'sochachem. You have one Torah for you. If you want to know the law in Egypt, in Sumerian, Babylonia, you usually have to make a chart, a big chart. Who sinned, who was sinned against, you know what I'm saying? You have to make a big chart, sometimes with 5 boxes, like a bingo card, sometimes with 7 or 8 boxes, because there's so many different levels. Right? If you're let's say, 1 being the highest, if you're a 6, doing even a slight fraction to a 1, they might kill you for that. Right? Okay? As opposed to 1 or 2, can you know, with impunity, he's just a 5, he's a 7, nah. Yes. Did you forget it? Okay. All right. So, along the line of Sean Paul draws to our attention how different some parts of Mishpatim are from everything else that's out there. By all means, that's not Sean Paul's Kiddush. That Yecheskel Kaufman spoke about that 70 years ago. But there's some mitzvahs. I mean, look, how different is the Torah going to be if you steal a sheep? In some societies, you kill the steal machine. Like this country. In 1840, you rustle someone else's cattle, they'll kill you. Right? And the governor will have you hanged. In other words, that's the law of the land. Not just because you're in my property, I'm going to shoot you. No.
He said that somewhere.
When it comes to stealing sheep, some countries have 7-fold punishment, some countries have the death penalty. So is 4 and 5 for sheep and an ox so different than what's out there? Certainly not across the whole corpus of law. Right? But we analyzed 3 or 4 laws where Shlomo Paul analyzes 5 or 6 works. Yecheskel Kaufman analyzed scores, and he said there is no precedent for the draconian punishment of death for beating and cursing parents. Nothing.
obviously these recently freed slaves, the Torah wants to be very, very strict with them about family, you know, patriarchy, matriarchy, and the family structure. Some nations have a death penalty for beating, not a death, but some very, very creative punishments for beating your father but not beating your mother. Right? Torah treats them exactly like in all cases. Sometimes puts the mother first, sometimes puts the father first. Right? Okay, the other example I think we gave, remember, was kidnapping. So there too, we just free the slaves, you know? We take our liberty very seriously. There's no ancient culture that has the death penalty for kidnapping. Right? Of course, the kid was found alive. The kid was found dead, he just gets killed for murder. Right? Okay. At this point, if you recall, we talked about the, you know, is it an unfair advantage? Of course it is, isn't it? Because no one's been studying a shnuna for the last 2,000, 3,000 years. But we offered the fact that Parshas Mishpatim requires, it's written in a way which requires us to read alongside it an oral tradition. It's an oral tradition on the Code of Hammurabi. It says an eye for an eye, we assume that that's what it always meant, which drives us to a different tangent for us. Is it possible that an eye for an eye meant one thing in the desert and maybe turned to be mean another thing later? Is that the most controversial thing I've said this semester today? Is it possible that that's what it meant? Is it possible? I mean, there's a Tana in the Sefer Bava Kamma that says, Ayin tachas ayin mamash. Of course, there are Mishonim who say, no, we didn't really mean that, but you look up the Gemara and decide. All right? Now, that doesn't mean a thing. We don't decide our understanding of Judaism because of what one Tana says when 942 disagree. Right? But we do have something of an egalitarian system that gives that one Tana a say. And it gets put on the page. We didn't conscript him to just say, no, your opinion doesn't mean anything, so we're going to put you to the dustbin of history and no one's ever going to find out what you meant. No, we put minority opinion in the Talmud, even very unpopular minority opinion in the Talmud, such as a guy named Hillel at the end of the Sanhedrin, not Hillel was up in by any means, it's going to be 300 years later, a guy named Hillel who says there's no such thing as Mashiach. Mashiach already came. Maybe he's saying something against Jesus, I don't know. But he said Mashiach already came. And then the Gemara says afterwards, Chas v'Shalom was still looking for a savior. Was it, right? Why did they even put that statement in the Talmud? Right? Okay. So, there's a Tana who says, Ayin tachas ayin means mamash. I think that's what it meant. And the Rambam doesn't break this in the Mordechai Bruchim, but his son, Avraham, has a parish to the Torah, where he says, my father told me, that in the desert, it meant mamash, and that when it became more civilized, we could trump down the effects of the deterrent necessary to make sure people don't punch each other in the eye too much. Right? I think I gave you an example of this, that believe it or not, I found in the Vilna Gaon.
Yeah.
Raw. Isn't that crazy? Where he said that in the desert, Torah just says, give the goat a patch and let him go off into the desert. It doesn't say you throw him off a cliff. Where does it say that? It must have shown you. This is Tarsh. Go look for it this week. Right? It's in the second Aliyah. Go look for it. It says to send him to Azazel. Alright, so the Gemara tells us that Azazel means a mountainous cliff. That's one opinion. Lots of other opinions. Azazel is some kind of shade or something out there. You know, Sigirim, shaded. Look at this Pitzkarsha for that. Look at Rashi on the word. Don't offer sacrifices to the Sigirim. What does that mean? Sigirim? Offer sacrifices to ghosts? What does that mean? Capricorn? What is that? I ain't sure. I'm not going to give up on it. But he says that it's very possible that because in the desert, when you sent that goat away, that goat is kosher. That goat is Kodesh. Right? If something happens to that goat along the way, you've got to change the other one too. Because they're twins. Until that goat gets sent out, you haven't completed the system of your kippah. So that.
Looking up Azazel.
Okay. All right. So in Israel, it's a curse word today. Right, Lech Lazazel. So the Gaon says, all right, yeah, that's fine. When you're in the desert, and you give that little hotch, it's going to go out, and then no one's ever going to see it again. Right? But when you send that goat a couple of kilometers out of Yerushalayim, there are Jews living there. The next town has Jews in it. Right? There are Jews there. Someone's going to find that goat. And who knows? You're going to send a goat to be a big mechshol to people? No, you're going to make sure that goat dies so it doesn't. No one uses it. Right? Okay. Anyway, that is... okay. Remember the concept of lex talionis, an eye for an eye? We just discussed that. Remember the concept of vicarious punishment, which is very, very popular in the Jewish codes. I kill my neighbor's son, my son gets killed. I kill my neighbor's wife, my wife gets killed. That's called vicarious punishment. Someone else suffers for the sins of another. Got it? How does that fit in with, it says in the Torah, you pursue a salvani, but wait a second, there's also a pasuk that says, okay, I visit the iniquity of parents upon the children. Well, the Hammurabi is doing just that. This man kills his neighbor's child. Alright, so I'm going to visit this man's iniquity on his child. There's a pasuk in the Torah that says so. Now tell me the difference.
Didn't we say that latter pasuk is when the son follows the path of the father?
That's a Gemara and Brachos Daf Hey.
But you said that it's God doing it, not right.
A more apt difference, although that is more Brachos Daf Hey, this is a Medrash Tanoim on the pasuk in Devarim that says, why is this even a contradiction? You resolve the contradiction. Let's explain it away altogether. Lo Yisu Abo Sabon is spoken about the court of law. Right? Fokid Abo Mamos is spoken about God's head. God decides what he wants to do. He may punish someone today for something that happened 500 years ago. I'm going to judge what God does. I don't know how he works. His works are a mystery to me. Right? Okay, so it's possible. Fokid Abo Mamos is spoken about what God is doing. This pasuk, but it's Moses, it's spoken by the Parshas Kisetzi, a court of law. Why do I even have to be told such a thing? The answer is, because that's what they're doing all over. Alright? So the Torah is cleaning up a lot of 1,000 years of law.
Yes.
Worse thing, the human cannot do it, Harry.
Right.
Only God can do it.
Okay, he's going to say, is that fair? Okay. You'll get a ticket if you cross a red light, but a police car or an ambulance on an emergency is going to cross a red light. Alright, I will tell you this. I don't want to spoil it, but there's a Gemara in the Makos that says that's not fair, God should stop doing it too. And he quotes who knows the prophet that he quotes that says that God that he called God on it, God agreed to him, I won't do it anymore. Tichesky. Very lengthy. What?
Tichesko 18,
yes.
That's where last time.
Excellent, good. How did you remember that? Because 18 is Chai. Remember I told you at the time, you remember Chai 18? Okay. Alright, so if you create mnemonics, you all know what number comes after 18, and you can always remember what chapter 13, chapter 14, in every Sefer Tanakh, if you just train yourself to remember. So that works right there. Okay, good. Alright, so that's what we do on civil law. Next section is on wisdom literature. I must admit there's very little on that. But the essential, just know the essential differences. That's really what we want to do. The essential difference is that wisdom to a Sumerian, very important, they also want to know what makes the crops grow better. They also want... But there's so much superstition, they just feel that pouring milk and meat over the crops makes it grow better. How does that work? Well, it seems to work a lot better than what the Torah says. The Torah says just pray and give stuff and I'll make the rain come in the season. Does that make sense? Maybe they do something. Maybe the qualities of milk and meat mixed together make quick crops grow better. Remember I told you when I put some coffee on that plant that wouldn't grow and it looked like E.T. touched it? Remember?
So who knows? Maybe milk and meat is good for the crops. So the Torah says, Rachis be Korean Masakhot Rabbi Besa Shemalokha Losar Shalibahalimo. You want your crops to grow, you bring your ikur. Give it to the Kohen. Don't cook milk and meat together to make the crops grow. It's an incredibly ingenious explanation for the juxtaposition between Bikurim and Basav HaKhalav twice in the Torah. In Mishpatim and in Kisisa. Remember what I remember it's giving you one time this semester a parish of Karaites. The Karaites say, Reishis Bikurim Masachot to Bibisa Shemurim. Simple. Bring your Bikurim. You know what they say, Lo Sevashel Diba Chalevimo means? Sevashel means... Don't let the fruit fall off the tree. Pick it and give it to the Kohen. Because the Sevashel means to ripen. Anyone speak Hebrew? You know, to ripen, fruit ripen means a bishul beros. Right? Chalevimo is Mother Earth. The Gedim, a sholes, it refers to the fruit. Right? It's amazing. Right? The tree is giving birth to a fruit. It's a kid. Don't let it fall to the ground. Give it to the Kohen before the Kurim, before it falls. Carrots don't have also cholam. How do you like that? Amazing. Actually, believe it or not, carrots do have basal cholam because there's a third pasuk in the Torah, Parshas Re'eh, that isn't connected to the Purim. So I have something with that helpful point. Carrots don't have a set law. Everyone is you're able to interpret as you want as long as it has the rules of Shabbat. It's an interesting concept. Okay. So, but here's the point. Our purpose of Chochma is to turn to morality. Gracious Chochma Yiras Hashem. Remember that pasuk, it's crucial. Remember our four, we talked last class, we didn't spend a whole lot of time, you know, in the semester, but we talked last class about our four books of Chochma in Tanakh. Mishlei, Koheles, Shir HaShirim, and Tehillim. There's some pessimism in there, there's some optimism in there, there's some realism in there. It's some combination of those three. Guided by Yiras Shamayim is your solution to what Chachma means to the Jew. To be sure, if you read through Iyov and Mishlei, you have to know so much about zoology, about botany, about astronomy, about physics. You know, we'll say, trust me, I wrote a book on it. You have to know about just every element of human nature. It all comes through in Sefer Mishlei. Right? Who has the right to say? Are you so sure that if you spare the rod, just spoil the child? Right? He's right about discipline, but I'm opening the door. Remember, we talked about this last class to reinterpret what that discipline means. We had some machlokeses about what that rod referred to yesterday. Remember on Tuesday. So okay, that's what I'm going to do because the book is canonical. If the book was something that wasn't canonical, I'd say okay, all right. Shakespeare said that it was true then; it's not true now. Remember I gave you an example, if you read the books of the Apocrypha, you lose your old Mahabha. You need to read the Talmud, quotes the Apocrypha all over the place. Gemara says, outside of Tessin, Sanhedrin, if you read it as like a Tanakh book, what does it mean to read something as a Tanakh book? I just described that. Okay, now the fourth part, which is this last section of the example. So I'm giving so little time to it. But we talked about three particular artifacts. The Pim, be able to just identify. Okay, I know Pim was on the first section, but that's because of the linguistic set part, right? P Schneider. Remember that? 2/3. So just know, how much does a Pim weigh? 2/3 of a shekel. And it's short for P Schneider. Remember we talked about the board 3 times that the word P Schneider appears in the whole Tanakh with respect to inheritance, but only one gets P Schneider, which means double, but it can also mean 2/3. Eliyahu, where Elisha said, I want to be Pishnayim, which the Gemara admitted meant twice as much, but we gave a different interpretation, to mean 2/3. And even that was a lot to ask. But to say, I want to be twice as great as you, Rebbe, is it's chutzpah to the extreme, and it's hard to fathom anyone would ever say such a thing. To Eliyahu, right? So in the third one, is incontrovertible. Because Zechariah says, 2/3 of the Jews in this area will do this, and the remaining third, he says, Pishnayim. What would mean? Double the Jews will do this, and the remaining third, 2 Pishnayim, means 2/3. Right? I must tell you, that prophecy is, I hope, the Holocaust. Okay? The 2/3 of European Jewry that were killed. Why do I say I hope that? Because I'd rather that prophecy is in our past. I don't want to have to visit it again. You should see what Christians say about that prophecy. Be it as it may, I want to get into the prophecy itself. Just to the words. Pishnayim. So when you weigh this pin, we only got six. You only got six known in the world. I have this biblical coins. It's an amazing work. And on the page it says six pin. It has a picture of it. And I've held one with a glove on it. These things are 3,500 years old. And it says you can see the word pin in Saudi Arabia written on it. It's amazing. And there's a collector that I can bring it to a sixth grade class and I was teaching Shmuel off. So Shmuel passed it around everyone has put on gloves because you don't want your fingerprints or the acid of your fingers to get on. Okay. So and it weighs just exactly. I mean, I actually took a diamond weight to the class. We had shekels there, lots of thousands of shekels, and chassi shekels also. But for some reason, this one wasn't lucky to survive in those kind of numbers. Right? And that was, you get a 1909 VDV penny, and it's worth $40. Get a 1909 VDV penny printed minted in San Francisco, and that's worth $50,000. Right? So we weighed it on a diamond scale. We weighed it on the diamond scale, and it was minus 2/3, 0.6787118. Okay. So recognize that. The other one is Mesha stone, which I gave you, which we talked about. Remember the story in Malachim Bet of the war between Moab and Israel. Moab was a vassal state of Israel and it's serving them for 200 years. And then they rebelled against Israel. The rebellion was because the kings of the north in Shomron were so wicked that they were weakened and the Moabites rebelled. But in Tanakh, the kings of Shomron quelled the rebellion. In the Mesha stone, not so much. It seems that they were very successful. They wiped this. They successfully prosecuted their battle. All right, history is subjective. We have the upper hand because we're still here studying Malachim Bet. No Moabites anymore studying Meshas. All right, the stone is quite large. Be able to recognize the stone. I have a picture of it, possibly on the exam, with a few lines from it that you have to recognize, and in the very least, be able to identify some of it. I give it to you with Hebrew characters. You won't be able to read all of it, of course, but you'll see how close it is to Hebrew. Remember, we talked about Sukkim and Rus that Torah Tanina tried to explain in light of the differences between Moabite and Hebrew, and this stone really proves that there are, we don't have those differences. Right? Finally, the very last thing is the signal fires of Azeka. This might be, I'm leaving it for 5 minutes left in the semester, this might be the most fantastic thing found in archaeology in the last number of years. It's a very, very old thing. It's called the Lachish letters. It's one of the most, one of the longest protracted Hebrew material that we have. It's Hebrew. These are, of course, Ksav Ivri that you remember from one of the first classes we had. You can't read it unless you have a chart with the Ksav Asheri next to it. But you see, it's in your Chuvarit. How the alphabet itself has evolved over time. Remember, the very first lesson we talked about that. And the contents of this are up to different interpretations of what it's referring to. Right? And they refer, the chiddush I'm trying to make to you in these waning moments of the semester is that there's a story in Yirmiyahu chapter 34 that relates directly to these letters. And that when the Babylonians were storming down from the north, like Yirmiyahu predicted, that whenever they came to a city, that city would light these huge fires to make sure to let the other cities know it's time to bear down and put up your defenses. Okay, and they did it city after city, kept falling that way, but they at least were able to light the fires. So the next city, with the hopes, of course, it's false hope in the end, but with the hopes that they would be able to act truly. I think sometimes in risk, we just, all right, we're going to just go down to the next city and we'll bear down here and, you know, keep the, what do you call that? You surrender or something? I don't know.
I can make a suggestion.
Lachish was one of the large cities that says it's already back in Sefer Yitzchak and Sefer Yehoshua. So it was the last stronghold, because they felt if Lachish falls, then Yerushalayim will fall next. They just hoped, maybe if Lachish can stand up, and turn this wave back, at least Yerushalayim will be saved. So the letters talk about fires that they're looking for, and that they can't find. We can hear their hoofs. We know that there's stuff going on, but we don't see the fires. We don't know where they're coming from next. Are they coming from that direction? Are they coming from that direction? The article, the popular article is about 15 years ago already, a little more, is that represents what's written in chapter 34 of Sefer Yirmiyahu, where the prophet himself speaks about the futility of the people in Lachish and Azekah. Both those cities appear in these letters. Azekah apparently was the city that didn't light the fire for them, because the Babylonians came so quickly they didn't even have the chance to light the fires to warn the next city. And then Lachish, of course, fell in Yerushalayim shortly after. So if that's what this is, then this is fantastic. This is one of the most amazing archaeological finds. We found Birchas Kohanim, we found references to David HaMelech, but this is a long, protracted, in Hebrew, series of letters that can relate directly to something written in the Torah. That's quite amazing. Right, I gave you a few other articles in between where there's a list of names of Babylonian generals, and we have found that same list. It appeared that the New York Times wrote about this about 5-6 years ago. That only may very well be that Jeremiah was a historical figure. Alright, we work in this classroom with faith. None of what I did here this semester was meant to offer you any proof of anything. What we do this semester was to offer you evidence of things. And what's more important than any of this evidence is that Reishis Chochma Yiras Hashem is that we understand how the Torah came in the midst of all this and changed and made a revolution, which still stands to this day. So let's come in.